welcome here in the February cold. I hope we're doing well today, having a good one and ready for some investigations and inquiries with us here on Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and the website is redicecreations.com. We also have redicecreations.net for those of you who want to go straight to the radio archive. But don't miss our frequently updated news. We have a lot of stories for you there that are interesting and important to take a look at. Well, Carl Lehrberger is an environmental activist, renewable energy entrepreneur, researcher, and author who joins us today. He has studied archaeological and sacred sites in the Americas for over 25 years with a focus on the ancient peoples who came to the Americas long before Columbus. The culmination of his investigations is in the book Secrets of Ancient America, and that is what we're going to talk about here today. He has also been involved in rock art exploration and has come to a conclusion that we've been lied to about our history, and what is accepted as fact is indeed mythology. We'll get into some interesting aspects today about pagan Europeans and other cultures that have visited the Americas and talk about some of the reasons of what might have driven them there. This is supported, of course, by artwork and archaeological finds and so much more. And we're just going to dig deep into it here today. So stay with us for much more as we get started. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Heinrich, and greetings to your radio listeners.
You bet. Very good to have you here. It's going to be interesting. We have a lot to discuss here. So before we kind of get started into the main meat of the book here, Carl, tell us just how this topic came together for you and what lies at the background of your work on these topics.
Well, thank you again. And I guess it began at an early age. I've been drawn to esoteric thinking and alchemy, and in an attempt to understand the many mysteries and contradictions we find ourselves in this world, most of my early youth was spent focusing on the inner journey. And this included many adventures and expeditions throughout the Americas. This changed dramatically when I went to college at the University of Colorado and initiated a 40-year career in renewable energy that I still am involved as a professional renewable energy developer. And my company, Pure Vision Technology, is engaged in biomass utilization and advanced biorefining. And listeners that would be interested in more information on renewable energy development can visit our corporate website, www.purevisiontechnology.com. I suppose my beginnings of serious work in the new history of America began in 1986 when I read Barry Fell's book, America BC. Dr. Fell was a microbiologist at Harvard, but became one of the leading diffusionists of the day, providing many evidences and cases that document travelers from around the world visiting and settling in the Americas hundreds and thousands of years before Columbus. After reading Dr. Fell's book, I was amazed that more Americans didn't know some of what Dr. Fell talked about. And I've spent the last 25 years following Dr. Fell's trail, as well as many other diffusionists, and asking the question, what is the history of America before Columbus, and why is our true history being covered up? Listeners that are interested in the culmination of that research can visit my site, newhistoryofamerica.com, where I provide a little more details on the book Secrets of Ancient America.
Well, absolutely. Very good. There's so many interesting things here we can and should talk about pertaining to this work, of course. And I mean, we've talked many times in this program about the story of, you know, Columbus and all the indicators that there's definitely been so many explorers that came before him. And yet, despite that, the academics' resistance to kind of go in a different direction. I mean, even it is recognized, some of them, not at least the Norse explorers, etc., the Vikings, what have you, but it still kind of doesn't really budge. So Let's just try to get a little closer to that question, try to kind of present as well to the audience this very aspect that it's not a strange idea. It's not kooky. It's not out there. There's numerous indicators, archaeological evidence, etc., that we'll get into here today, that points in the direction that we've had Celts visiting America, the Phoenicians, Indians or Hindus. We have Olmecs, as I said, Vikings, but Egyptians, Japanese. The list just goes on and on. Let's just kind of summarize here, if we could, Carl, what you think is some of the best proof that we have currently for pre-Columbian explorations that you would, let's say, tell to the doubter who still don't believe that any of this actually occurred.
Well, this is how I start the book, and it starts out with the two stories of Columbus, and it presents the traditional story, and then it presents an alternative story, which, in summary, Columbus knew exactly where he was going. He was prepared for it. He had advanced knowledge of maps from both his wife's family, which was from the Sinclair family of Norway, as well as the Arab maps that were left in large Arab libraries when they abandoned Toledo. So Columbus and his brother had the maps. They knew where they were going, and it was a quest for gold, and ultimately became the beginning of the slave trade in America. So we have one story of American exceptionalism based on this great explorer Columbus. And then we have another story that Columbus was really the first conquistador, followed by many others, that instituted slavery and the stealing of the Americas for the church and the monarchies. So that's the background. And how we break through this is really the fundamental question. I'd say most of the documentation that I presented in my book is not my own documentation. It's the research of hundreds of others, of academics, archaeologists, independent researchers. So it's not me saying this. This has been going on for centuries. And to try to better understand what's going on, I created an antagonist that in the book I call the archaeopriest. And the archaeopriests really are the dominating ideology that of both the church, which wants to justify the conquest, as well as the archaeological community that wants to stay with a standard line. It's too difficult in many academic circles to admit you're wrong, and as a result, the archaeopriest community has not been willing to investigate many of these evidences and claims with an open mind. A great example, and to specifically address your question of what I found to be the best proof of the many hundreds of examples, is the Celtic expansion into North America. And we see evidence of the Celts, the early Celts in New England, including archaeological sites that can be visited today, artifacts in museums that have Ogham writing, which is written in the Celtic language. And from their stronghold in New England, thousands and thousands of years ago, at least going back to the time of Christ, and I would argue thousands of years before that, the Celts expanded throughout America, mostly using the river systems. And the best documentation that I found of Celtic explorers in the Americas are in the states of Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma, in the center of our country. And I don't want to give the audience the impression that the petroglyphs and epigraphy and writing of old world travelers in America is abundant. Most of the petroglyphs in America, 99.999%, are made by the ancestors of the Native Americans. However, there are at least a handful of absolute proof and another dozen or so very indicative of proof that the Celts were here. And we know they were here because they left their writing in stone, often in caves. And the writing can be read in Celtic languages. And the writing usually addresses rituals. And these rituals were celebrated around the celestial days of equinox, to a lesser extent solstice, but in some cases the cross-quarter days. And so that not only do we have the Ogham writing that can be read in Gaelic, addressing a ritual or a celebration, but we have a corresponding alignment of the sun and shadows falling on these petroglyphs on the specific days, an area known as archaeoastronomy. So as an example, in a cave in Colorado, there's an Ogham inscription, and I want to say that Ogham is a writing system, that read in a Gaelic language states, "The sun strikes here on the day of Bel," B-E-L, the sun god, the ancient sun god.
Yeah.
And sure enough, on the equinox, the sun streams into the cave and strikes that surface on that day. And you can see it the day before and the day after, not quite making it. So we have the writing, we have the archaeoastronomy, and we have the context, the celebration of Bel. And this example was repeated in another, I'd say, 7 or 8 cases, you know, throughout the 3 or 4 state area. Now, just to kind of end this, the story, in other areas of the United States, for example, West Virginia, there are writing, Ogham writing in caves, but they're a later script, if you will, to read them, one would use Old Irish. So we can see that there was a separation in time from these explorers that made it perhaps down the Mississippi or up the Mississippi to the Arkansas River and then into the tributaries leading them into Kansas and Colorado, say 2,000 years ago, with later day Europeans that spoke Old Irish that made it to West Virginia, perhaps 1,000 or 1,200 years later. So I found the best proof to be the Celtic explorers, but there are many other stories, many other artifacts, and many other explorers that made it to the Americas.
Well, exactly. Many more I want to talk with you about here, but let's talk about Ogham a little bit and what Barry Fell actually, you know, came across, what he discovered, because this is just fascinating, and I've always been intrigued by this as well, and the very aspect that, of course, you do find, you know, Ogham script in Ireland, in other parts of the world as well, and I'm just amazed that still, despite this, people have been trying to, you know, to debunk Barry Fell's work and say it's not real, or, you know, someone has made it up, right? There's all of these controversies surrounding the work, but I haven't found any indications that that would be the case. I mean, this is real finds. They're in the Americas, and they point to the fact of pre-Columbian contact, right?
Yes, but it's there's really more to the story, and it's not black and white regarding Dr. Fell. I'm going to say most of my colleagues and diffusionists that I know really got interested in this area by reading Dr. Fell. But we also, those of us that have really studied it, have concluded that Dr. Fell did make some mistakes. He really did. And as a result of those mistakes, it left him vulnerable to the critique and actually the discrediting by the archaeological community and the archaeopriests. And you make one mistake, it's really enough to almost kill you. And that was the case with him in academia. And he, after, you know, an example would be that he would interpret a stone carving based on a photograph. And the photograph didn't bring out some of the lines, and it was a misinterpretation. And that was just kind of one example where he was hung out to dry. So, you know, some people, even diffusionists, think Barry Fell could have done a disservice because of how he approached this. That's not my opinion. He did make mistakes, but he blazed a path, and one of his great contributions was that he discovered that there is abundance cases that Ogham writing exist in the Americas. He focused on New England, but as my book demonstrates, there's dozens of cases, and most of the Ogham, which is a series of lines that spell letters, it's a vowel-less system, are written vertically. And most of the monuments in Ireland and England that do have Ogham, you see it vertical, although there are some cases of horizontal Ogham. Nearly all Ogham that we see here in the United States, including Colorado, is horizontal. So the experts, the so-called experts, say, hey, that can't be Ogham because it's horizontal, it's not vertical. Well, there are cases of horizontal Ogham in Europe, and there are cases of a vertical Ogham, what we call here tree Ogham, here in the Americas. So that argument just goes out the window. The what makes the case for Ogham so remarkable is that it can be read. What makes it so controversial is that there are thousands of cases of these lines that are Ogham-like, and that's the distinction that a scientific person has to make. There's Ogham inscriptions that can be read, and there's Ogham-like characters that have the look of Ogham, but they were not necessarily Ogham or a language at all. So sifting through this, the archaeopriest community has just thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Ogham can't exist. Those are scratchings or for tool sharpening. But when one gets into it, the case can be made that there are dozens of inscriptions in Ogham throughout the Americas, in addition to artifacts that contain Ogham and that can be seen in museums in Vermont.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Now, of course, as you said, it's very difficult to pin down an exact date on these. That's just how it goes with stones. It could go back as far as, 1,000 years BC, and it would be interesting to hear why you think that as well on top of it. But after that, maybe we can talk a little bit more about what we believe that they did there, right? That they came as traders and their activities, because they spread over a pretty wide area. But what would you say about the dating here and how far back Celtic visitation actually occurred in the Americas?
Well, Heinrich, you hit upon another controversial and very difficult point to nail. And from what we have seen, there's no one precise dating system where we can say it's this date. And at best, we can apply different technologies. For example, a technology called Kakton dating that attempts to date the patina of the petroglyphs, and this is an experimental procedure, but the Kakton radio dating experiments conducted in Colorado indicate a range of about 1800 to about 2200 years. We also have to look at the context of what these inscriptions read and apply some estimate, but this is one of the greatest areas of where we could use help from the scientific community. And up to this point, the experts in dating, in epigraphy, in archaeology, in archaeoastronomy, in anthropology have been reticent to become involved in diffusionist research or exploring Dr. Fell's claims, because they would be ridiculed by their community. And as a result of this, you can go to the Four Corners area of Colorado, known for its Anasazi runes like Mesa Verde, and you can see literally hundreds of graduate students, archaeologists doing research, in known Anasazi and later Native American sites, but at these old world sites that I list in the book, you won't find any archaeologists looking at them. So really, to answer your question, we have to have more involvement by the scientific community, something that hasn't come forward today. Now, my opinion is that the Celts were first arrived here as part of the greater copper trade that was going on between Europe and the Mediterranean and North America, specifically from the Great Lakes in Michigan, and that was the early driver for bringing the Celts here, who later, perhaps hundreds of years, perhaps as you suggest, 1,000 years, began to settle in New England and then expand westward. So the dating is tough, but based on the carbon dating, based on research by others, we anticipate that it was at least 2,000 years ago. And again, it's a range. And that's why I brought up the point about these old Irish visitors from West Virginia being a different group of people separated by at least, I would say, 1,000 years from the Celtic inscriptions that we see in Colorado. So it wasn't one date or even, you know, one period, that they came in waves based on the political climate, based on trading, and also, of course, climate conditions that ancient drove people to the Americas.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of different things occurred. What's interesting here, too, I think, is, you know, the relationship with Carthage or you know, the Phoenicians. Because one of the questions here is, of course, how the Celts find out first about the Americas and how far back that knowledge actually goes. And it might be quite a bit. As far as I know, anyway, there's no clear indication, for example, of Ogham script in Ireland that references their travels much in the same way, let's say, that some of the runestones do of the Vikings. But nonetheless, we can... This trading aspect is definitely known, and even when Rome's fought with the Carthaginian Empire in Northern Africa, it's speculated that some of them, together with some of the Celts from Gaul, etc., actually took off and went to the Americas as well. That's again pre BC actually. But what would you say there in terms of how they actually found out first about how and where to go when it comes to the Americas?
Well, I would add to your point about the Phoenicians. Barry Fell and most diffusionist writers, I think, believe that the Phoenicians were perhaps the earliest group on the East Coast, driven by that copper trade, and they were clearly the masters of the sea. And they had the knowledge to get here, and it was a secret. They didn't share that with other groups. So you would have other groups, perhaps like the Celts, perhaps like the Hebrews, that would contract with these Phoenician merchants who knew the way, who had the crews, and that they would come over here on these Phoenician vessels. And you know, there is extensive evidence of Phoenician travelers, including coins, including inscriptions on rocks. So there is an incredible background of information that the Phoenicians made it not only to North America, but in Central America and South America, and probably in South America, some of the best known artifacts of the old world travelers are from Ecuador. And these are gold artifacts that have since disappeared, but were thoroughly documented by Father Crespi, who had an extensive collection. So the Phoenicians really, I think, as the merchants of the day, were able to bring other groups over here, and eventually those groups learned how to get here themselves and established their own merchant marines. Travel routes, and would even go so far as to set up locations here in North America or welcome centers where they could arrive and stage their expeditions into the inlands for copper and for explorations.
Yeah, there's so many interesting finds here as well, Carl. I mean, you mentioned the copper mines. Let's just talk about those a little bit more and what some of the things are that actually have been found there in Michigan, because this is a massive quarry, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's correct. And like just about everything else in the new history, the traditional archaeologist and the archaeopriest community discount that these copper mines were being used by the old world peoples. The copper coming out of Michigan was perhaps the purest copper on the planet. It was 99% pure copper. And diffusionist scholars represent that this copper from America really drove the Bronze Age. However, you won't hear that rendition in any textbook or by any traditional archaeologist. So these are not deep mines, these are surface mines. So the copper was very easy to come by with Neolithic tools, and it was refining because it was so pure, it didn't have to be refined. So this is the copper making its way back to Europe that drove the Bronze Age, and really, I would argue, propelled the diffusion of old world peoples from Europe and the Mediterranean to the Americas.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what about it seems to be indicative of the fact that once the Celts kind of got over to the Americas, and again, this could be extended over a very long time, of course, but they obviously brought their traditions with them. They brought their culture with them. They brought, their way of life and certain religious ceremonies, etc. We do have things like, America Stonehenge, for example, up in New England, and there are other finds that seems to be indicative of the aspect that they brought some of these, things with them, their traditions with them, basically. Tell us a bit more about New England specifically and some of the finds we have there. I mentioned the Stonehenge there, but there's numerous other ones as well, which I didn't know about until a few years ago. It's just remarkable that these are aspects not touched, if you will, by the mainstream.
Well, when I was reading America BC, I happened to be in New England in 1986 and 87. So it was a great opportunity for me to explore what Dr. Fell had talked about. And probably the first explorations were what they call stone chambers. And these are very similar to what you find throughout Celtic Europe. They're just that, stone chambers, usually facing east or west. And in some cases, they had some kind of alignment associated with them. And in a very few cases, on the lintel stone, they might have an inscription. There are literally hundreds of these stone chambers that dot the New England countryside that modern historians attribute to colonists, and they call them root cellars. But, in my exploration, this is just not the case, that they were here long before the colonists. You mentioned America Stonehenge in southern New Hampshire, and that's probably the most extensive archaeological site of the Celts, and it's a phenomenal archaeoastronomy center because by standing at the center of the site on kind of a hill at the center of the site, you can look out on the horizon and see the marker stones that they were able to determine the equinoxes, the solstices, the cross quarter days, as well as some of the lunar positions. On the southernmost extreme position of the moon on the horizon, called the lunar standstill. There are other smaller Celtic-like settlements in Vermont, and as I mentioned, there are in Vermont in at least one museum artifacts that show the Ogham writing on stones, and as well as a sculpture. So there are artifacts for those who choose to look for them, but the standard line of the archaeopriest is that there are no artifacts. Well, the truth is there are artifacts in the form of coins and other things like that. But leaving that aside, the true artifacts are the writing themselves in stone, often accompanied by archaeoastronomy phenomena that's referenced in the writing itself.
Let's talk about archaeoastronomy a little bit more, about some of the, you know, the equinox days, the cross quarter equinox days, and the fact that we can find these, you know, these things kind of inscribed into some of the monuments. You've done some really interesting work on, of course, detailing and showing this, which means you might be able to look at a site somewhat differently than someone who doesn't know about that and effectively would throw it out and say, you know, it's natural or someone else built it later, what have you. But it's very indicative of the same type of culture that we've seen. Well, you know, just to preface though, of course, you have solar worship in a lot of places, you know, specifically on the Northern Hemisphere. But nonetheless, you do have a kind of a overlap between, you know, some of the sites of like Stonehenge and Newgrange or what have you in Europe. And then you find them later in the Americas. But break that down for us a little bit about what you found and what some of the points are here in terms of how you, you know, went about to discover that there is kind of encoded into some of the sites an astrological meaning, something which is tied to the sun and the moon, Carla.
Oh, that was so well stated. And if we can understand that the archaeoastronomy, which is kind of a combination of archaeology and astronomy, is considered a pseudoscience by many archaeologists and many archaeopriests. Because in addition to dealing with the actual movement of the sun and moon and the planets, which is science, it often involves an interpretation of these phenomena, if you will, the light and the shadow at a specific time of day falling on a monument or on a petroglyph, as we see in Newgrange is a great example. I highlight the work of Martin Brennan, who is an Irish, I'd say storyteller, from the United States, and his work in Newgrange and explaining that the archaeoastronomy really was the language of the ancients. This is how they thought. This is how they communicated. So when they built a structure, as you say, encoded in that structure was the movements of the sun or perhaps the planets, and in some cases the moon. And this archaeoastronomy aspect is what most modern archaeologists have either don't have the background or they've chosen to ignore it. By looking down and looking for artifacts, one loses the ability to look up and see that there's more going on in terms of the language and the art that the ancients have left for us. So many our archaeology sites have not even been looked at from the point of view of the impact of the sun and the light and the shadows on specific days that they celebrated. So as an example, you know, on the day of Bel, the sun strikes here. On the day of Bel, we gather for rituals. These are specifically talking about the rituals and the cosmology of the ancients that they have encoded, you know, into their petroglyphs, so that they're not just petroglyphs. Wow, how pretty. They're not just calendrics. Wow, it lines up on the equinox. It's presenting a cosmology, an integrated cosmology. And when one looks at how they presented a petroglyph, say, of the sun god, in one case we have identified him in Colorado as Mithras, we see on the day of Bel, the alignment of the sun going into shadow as the Lord of Night, Anubis, is illuminated. So in by using archaeoastronomy, as the sun goes down, the sun god goes into shadow, the Lord of Night is illuminated and takes over from the sun god. This, if you don't have a background in archaeoastronomy and you're just looking at a petroglyph of a canine, you're going to say, hey, that's a dog. And if you're looking at the petroglyph of the sun god, you'll say, well, that's just an anthropomorph. But when you add the archaeoastronomy and you see on this particular day of Bel, on the equinox, the shadows lining up in such a way that they precisely, intentionally tell a story, that's what archaeoastronomy is about. And what we find at the ancient old world sites, as well as Native American and ancestors to the Native Americans at their sites, they're replete with archaeoastronomy. So what archaeology has to do is become more integrated and take what they claim to be pseudosciences and integrate it to have a more thorough understanding of not only who was here, but the messages they left encoded in stone.
Yeah, indeed. Now, there are a couple of other interesting examples. I don't want to jump too far ahead of ourselves, but it's kind of connected overall here, but what we're talking about. But just the aspect that it's not only maybe what you build, but it's also how you, you know, utilize the landscape around you, because some aspects here, they've used not only, you know, caves, but actually, you know, rock faces, for example, how the sun hits in a certain way. And it seems to, some of them are actually developed in such a way that the language itself, as you said, is written over a portion where the sun hits on the opposite side of for example, a cliff or something like that. So you get kind of a shape by the shadow, and that the language is kind of defined around that. And I have no idea what some of them say, of course, if this is in reference to you know, this kind of knowledge or what have you. Maybe we can talk about that. But my point being here, and my question is, this means that it's not always just that they've built something from scratch up, right? It's that they've utilized the natural surroundings and the natural landscape, but still kind of turning that into a form of a temple, if I can call it that, correct?
Yes. What we find mostly, well, I don't want to say mostly, but we find a great deal of monumental archaeoastronomy in Europe, you know, sites like Newgrange and sites like Stonehenge. In the Americas, with the exception of America Stonehenge, perhaps, that we talked about earlier, most of the archaeoastronomy that I've seen is petroglyphic. So a fixed petroglyph on a cave wall, for example, will have the sun and the shadows form on it at different times of the day. And over the course of the year, those sun and shadow lines move. So the key aspect of identifying archaeoastronomy is if it's intentional. So one could argue that there's solar interaction with petroglyphs every day of the year, and that is often the case. But it's the interaction that is very specific, as the case that I made before of the Colorado Cave, where the inscription reads, "The sun strikes here on the day of Bel."
Yeah.
Well, that only happens on one day. It's very precise, and there's a count leading up to that day. So you can see 3 days before that day, the shadow falls on the third tick of the count. So the key aspect of archaeoastronomy is to not just look at a interplay of light, shadow, and petroglyphs and say, wow, there's an interaction. The point is to demonstrate that there was an intention to have that archaeoastronomy event or that alignment take place on a specific intentional day and for a specific reason. And that's really the most important aspect of archaeoastronomy. And, you know, regrettably, one could say it's not a complete science. It does require interpretation. And this is where I think the archaeopriest and many mainstream archaeologists, you know, throw up their hands. Nevertheless, the cases of the Celts, and I would argue other cultures that made it to America, clearly demonstrate that there was intentional creations of the archaeoastronomy to coincide with specific petroglyphs to tell a story. And these stories usually go back to their cosmology and the worship of their deities, including the sun god. Another, you know, point is with the Celts in a cave in Oklahoma, it's not that we've just found the sun god and Anubis, the Lord of Night, but there are also very specific images of goddesses. A very specific image of a Sheila na gCig, which is a Irish or a goddess that is prevalent in Europe, but we don't, you know, usually think of a Sheila na gCig finding its way into Oklahoma, but clearly that is the case. So they did leave cultural remnants, but these remnants are bought alive by the archaeoastronomy that really tell a bigger story that's tied to the cosmology of these ancient peoples.
Yeah, definitely. You have some great images, obviously in color, about halfway through in the book, and showing some of the different ones. Like, for example, in you know, Wyoming, then you have the Crack Cave in Colorado. There's more the Anubis cave, and it's really interesting how this is tied together. Now, is this indicative of pointing back to the one and the same culture, or do you think that we've had you know, influences back and forth? Is this something that's evolved over time? Because that's, of course, another aspect of this, that things might transform or even deteriorate over time, and depending on if these were you know, permanent settlements or not, if there were, of course, contact with other peoples, it's much something that has been even lost or changed over time. So that could be another interpretation. You said before that some of them were written, for example, you know, horizontally as opposed to vertically, but this could simply just be a transformation over time, correct?
This is really one of the most fascinating aspects of the new history. And what I've found is that there is encoded in the rocks in North America is new information for European history, because much of that history was destroyed by the Romans and by the church.
Exactly.
Remnants of it remain here, and I'll give you an example to emphasize the great point you made. I noted that in Oklahoma, there's a cave that is called Anubis Caves because of the canine figure that is clearly an Anubis, an Egyptian deity, and the sun god has been identified as Mithras. Well, Europeans may be familiar with Mithras and the slaying of the bull. But what in doing research we find is that Mithras originally came from India as Mitra. And as he traveled, he did make it to Europe, and then eventually was adopted by the Romans as the god Mithras. And we in Oklahoma, we see the Mithras character prior to really the Roman incarnation of Mithras, where he's not the bull slayer that is so typical of the images of Mithras. Mm-hmm. So we have kind of a earlier image than most of the images of Mithras that we see in Europe. But here's the point. At another site in California that we identify as a old world site from Trans-Pacific Ocean explorers, we have a image of what was more akin to a Mitra image or a Shiva image. And it really makes, and you compare these images from Oklahoma circa the time of Christ, and these images from California perhaps 1,000 years or more earlier. And we can see some distinct similarities, and we can see some distinct differences. And what I claim in the book is that what we're seeing in California is the earlier, perhaps earliest example of this sun god image with a pointy hat, and as opposed to the later day version of the sun god in Oklahoma that has stars and a crown. So we can see the symbols themselves changing over time, and I think we'll be able to fill in some significant gaps of the travels of the sun god through different cultures and around the world by more fully understanding a new history of America, that these different cultures over different times made it here, left their mark, and only to be forgotten or lost, and in many cases destroyed in the old world, yet there still are records here documented that they were here.
See, that's very interesting. It could literally be that if you want to go kind of find some of our pagan roots, certain things might actually be found in the Americas that has no longer any equivalent in Europe. That's both fascinating and sad, of course, at the same time. But it's really indicative, perhaps, of the termination of the old, cultures in Europe, and that, of course, we were one of the early victims of this religious fervor that went on in Europe. Because I think it was even Scott Volter talked about that too. That he even theorized that a potentiality of the later movement of the church over to the Americas might have been due to the fact that they were on the trail of someone, really. I think he formulated that in the point of view of the Knights Templar, but I think it might go much further back than that. But yeah, that's very interesting to recognize that aspect, that there might be lost traces of European heritage in the Americas that are not in Europe.
It's remarkable. It really is.
Now, tell us, there are a couple of more things I want to squeeze in here, Carl, before we take a break. Let's just we talked quite a bit about the Celts, obviously, and there's just so much more. We're just kind of scraping the surface here a little bit. But Egyptian, Hebrew, as we say, kind of Canaanites and Phoenician scripts, and there's just a ton of different stuff here. Tell us about Egyptian influences, and is there full-on hieroglyphic finds in the Americas?
Well, the answer is yes and no. I spent, I'd say, four chapters writing on the Celts because I had what I believed is smoking gun proof that we have the evidence. When it comes to many of the other explorers, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's a lot of evidence that's questionable and controversial. And the case can be made, but when at the end of the day, when you say, "Can you prove that the Egyptians were here?" You're not going to. I couldn't find a case that would say I can prove it. Now there certainly are Egyptian influences. We know that just by the Mississippi River itself, the name of the Mississippi River invokes Isis, and so there are so many indications. There have been, in the book, I show a couple of artifacts that have hieroglyphics, Egyptian hieroglyphics, and there are numerous reports of objects with hieroglyphics, these objects aren't considered proof. Because they walk. In other words, a petroglyph on a stone panel is not going to walk away. And nobody could really fake it. But a artifact like a coin or a stone, a piece of stone with an inscription, that's less proof, if you will. But I guess to be very specific, To your question, I do believe the Egyptians were here. There are artifacts. I have seen specific glyphs referencing gold in Nevada that are Egyptian glyphs. The Mississippi River, and many other artifacts. So there's proof that the Egyptians were here, not quite as strong. There's proof that the Hebrews were here. Here the case is I think a little stronger. We have stone writing in New Mexico. We have later day Hebrew Romans that left writing in Latin in Arizona around 900 AD. So these cases are cited in the books, as are incidents of Japanese connections. Connections with Chinese explorers, and of course, Indus Valley people, including Greater India and other areas of Indo-Turkey.
Yeah.
So the case may not be quite as strong, but if you go down the road of any one culture like Egyptians, there's an abundance of relics, of evidence, of writing, and a lot of stories that can't be corroborated.
Yeah, exactly. I was looking at the Bat Creek Stone, for example. It was found in Tennessee in 1889. Just fascinating. You know, what is that?
Well, like so many cases, there's just every artifact is surrounded by controversy. The Bat Creek Stone was allegedly dug out of a mound. That was attributed to early ancestors of the Native Americans by a researcher who worked for the Smithsonian, and he presented the artifact to his boss, who Cyrus Thomas, who interpreted it as a Cherokee inscription that was published by the Smithsonian. Diffusionist researchers determined that it had been read upside down. And instead of being Cherokee, it was a Semitic script that talked about a star as a pre-Hebrew script talking about, I think the phrase was a Star of David or something like that. But because it's a single artifact, and because it has been thoroughly trashed, if you will, by the archaeopriest community, there's so much now doubt that even when you go to Wikipedia and look at it, I think there's kind of more write-up on the skeptics of it than the people who agree, you know, that it is an actual inscription. But, you know, what I found that is most disturbing for any researcher in this area is the abundance of hoaxes and fakes. And especially in the Midwest, where I was presented with, copper plates with writing that was supposed to be old world, only to find out that a chemical analysis of the copper alloy indicated it had been smelted with modern techniques.
Yeah.
So, you know, one has to be so very careful. But in the case of some artifacts, they're better than others. I would say that the Back Creek Stone is one of the examples most often cited as Hebrew, and I'd say it's a good indication how it got into that mound, and was it a fake? I can't say for 100%, and I don't know at this point if anyone can. However, there are artifacts, and I'm not talking about rock art, but there are actual artifacts that we can say prove the case. And one of these is a Samaritan cuneiform small tablet that was given to, I can't remember his name, but the general who defeated Chief Joseph, the Nez Perce Indian chief, in 1877. And as a gift, Chief Joseph presented the general with this cuneiform tablet that he wore around his neck. and this tablet has been ascribed to be 4,000 years old as Assyrian cuneiform. So this artifact, I believe, is still in the Naval History Museum, if you will. I'm not sure it's on display, but it's clearly an artifact. It's clearly in the hands of the government, and it has been determined to be ancient by experts. So it's not that there aren't artifacts to be found. There are many artifacts, some more conclusive than others.
Well, exactly. This is kind of our stance on the program as well overall, that, you know, we should keep an open mind, but not so open that our, you know, brain falls out. We can't, you know, believe everything. And just because there are forgeries out there too, doesn't mean that there aren't real finds that indeed are very interesting, that deserves our, you know, attention. And you always kind of get a degree of muddying of the waters in these kinds of areas, which makes it a tricky territory. But I think you do a great job in the book, Carl, in terms of how you tie it together and the different cultures that you focus on and recognize the correlation to their existence in other parts of the world, and the fact that they went over to the Americas for trade and for many other reasons and purposes as well. So why don't we do like this? We can take a short break here and then pick up in the second segment. I want to ask you much more, of course, about the book. I definitely want to get into the Norse and the Viking stuff a little bit in the second. I always find that highly fascinating, and I love that you wrote some about Thor Heyerdahl as well. So we'll talk more about that. But let's just kind of give out the details here about the websites again, where people can go to pick up copies of this of the book that we've been talking about. And just let me reiterate the title here again for folks. It's called Secrets of Ancient America: Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. So give us your websites again, Carl, so people know where to go to pick up a copy of this book.
www.newhistoryofamerica.com.
Very good. We're going to have that linked up, of course, on the website. And then also additional links for the energy website was purevisiontechnology.com if you want to check that out as well. But we have much to talk about here, Carl. So stay with us. We'll take a short break and then we'll be right back with more. we will pick up after the break in the second hour at redicemembers.com, our members website. You can go there to sign up and tune in. You can also read more about it there. Our archives goes back to 2006. We have a lot of different topics available for you on the members website. And by the way, the euro is weak against the dollar right now. So you Americans should take the opportunity to sign up if you haven't already. It's only 15 euros for a 3-month subscription anyway, and that's only 5 euros per month. But, you know, we have over 900 programs available for you. We have videos, TV episodes, inside episodes, and we have a lot more videos in the works as well. And by the way, before we proceed, I just want to let you know that we have Olav Thorheim from Norway for our next program on the symbolic nature of language, demonstrating the differences between people due to what language they use that describes the world around them. Really interesting stuff. Then we have another 314 show, and after this we have Nick Kellerstrom on that untouchable topic of World War II and the Holocaust. He's a British academic who's gone rogue. Fascinating. Don't miss that program. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who want to stay with us here into the next hour, the second segment for our members, the website, once again, is redicemembers.com. And you can, of course, tune in whenever it suits you, on demand, stream, or download. So do check it out if you are interested. So thank you for listening. We'll talk to you right after the break.